In case you're just joining us, we just wrapped up with Dr. Tim Ball, one of the leading skeptics in the fight against global warming. He just won one of his three court cases where he was accused of defaming scientists who want the world to spend $100 trillion or more to possibly lower the Earth's temperature by half a degree, maybe, or at least they hope. You know, it's always nice when good guys win. Speaking of good guys, there's a new candidate in town. I'd like to welcome Captain Greg Wooldridge to the show. He is a former Navy pilot, the only commanding officer to lead the famous Blue Angels team on three separate tours, and he is now running for governor. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mark. I'm glad to be here. This is awesome.
Yeah, you know, it's great to talk to you. You're a former Navy pilot, a commander of the Blue Angels, which are absolutely amazing. Had the chance to see them once up in Hillsborough. Especially considering the precision, not just of the pilots, but the entire crew. You commanded a naval base as well, and you're a motivational speaker on high-performance teams, speaking to audiences about what it takes to lead high-performance teams like the Blue Angels. You've had a tremendous amount of success, and you're out there retired from the Navy, enjoying the fruits of a life well-lived, and suddenly you decide to run for governor. Was there a tipping point for you? Did something happen, or the governor sign something that made you say, that's it, I have got to do something to turn Oregon around?
Well, I kind of got drafted into this, but I am so pleased that they found me. Late last summer, a couple of friends of mine who both have served in the Oregon, one in the Senate, one in the House, came to me and said, look, we've got an idea for you that we've floated around the state, and it's getting wide applause. And that is that you run for office. And I said, oh, come on, you know, I've never held office before. And they said, no. That's good. No blowing record. That's a good thing. And over a couple more of my objections, they said, no, that, you know, we can work. We can make that work. And I thought about it. And I finally, after watching the field and then just watching Kate Brown just continue to do this nonsense and not solve the problems in Oregon. And Oregon's in a tailspin. Let's face it. It's heading for the ground. If we don't get somebody in there to fly that airplane that knows how to run, you know, has the courage and the leadership. And I think that's the big thing that's missing. And I feel like because of my experience in the military, and then even after that, and going around talking to folks and seeing the leaders in these major companies and minor companies and seeing how they lead, all that exposure to that has really put a lot of arrows in my quiver to pull when I need it leading things. And that's what I'm fired up about. And, you know, yeah, like you said, I could have gone on to do some of those other easy things in life, but I've never run from a challenge. I've run two challenges, and that's what I feel here. This is a challenge. It's an opportunity to take this beautiful state, this great state, and the great people here, and put it at the top of the state's list instead of at the bottom where it ranks in so many areas.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Oregon is doing terribly right now. Unfortunately, our media doesn't always do a good job of covering that. But, you mentioned the field, and we know that you're a conservative. And among your Republican opponents, there are two other conservatives out there. Bruce Cuff, a lot of people are saying he doesn't really appear to be a serious contender, but there is also Sam Carpenter, who also has a background in business. Why did you jump in if there's already two conservatives in the race? And also, why should a conservative support you over these other two?
Yeah, well, I like Bruce and I like Sam. They're good guys. How do I put it? I think I would be a better leader, and I think I can beat Kate Brown, and that's the issue. I can beat Kate Brown, and that's I'll let the competition between us three conservatives go its route. I think people will pick me because I have that drive. I have that passion for the job. I want to build the trust between myself, not only myself, but state government and the electorate and the people of Oregon. They don't trust state government. And that's, you know, I think I have some tools. I have some, you know, I just have the passion to make that happen. And so, you know, you want to separate me from Sam and Bruce? I don't know. I don't know how to do that. I mean, I could, but that's not really what we want to talk about, I don't think. So, I bring it. So,
well, you mentioned trust, and that is such a huge integral part of building successful teams. And I think you're right, is that most people don't trust government. In fact, that's the whole point of the iSpy show, is that we don't trust government. We're keeping an eye on big government. How do you go about getting that trust rebuilt, not only between people and their government, but even within the government itself, between those different agencies?
Right. Well, you know, of course, Dennis Richardson, our new, relatively new Secretary of State, is doing an awesome job with the challenge of doing the audits on all the agencies, and he's revealing so much waste. Most of his audits aren't applauded by Governor Brown. They should be. It's cleaning things up. That's where you start building that trust. And should the agency heads be the ones that are, you know, allowing that to happen? Well, then we get new wingmen out there, right? We get a new formation of people that are going to head in the same direction. And now we have trust within the government itself. And once we build that trust within the team, can emanate that out to the public and get the veracity and get their, just go back to that word trust, get them to understand that we are being honest, open, and real with them, transparent, no secret handshakes, and then we build that back. And they've got to know that we're here to serve them, not them to serve us.
You mentioned trust and these audits. I think that is a big key, because what that really boils down to is you're demanding that the government is responsible and that it acts responsibly. Yes. within its structure, but also certainly on the fiscal side of things. I mean, we see that kind of waste all the time in government.
Right. If we don't keep on top of it, which Dennis is doing now, if we don't keep on top of it. No, wasn't that Kate Brown's agency for a while?
Yeah.
So, you know, why all of a sudden does this, now these big numbers are popping up. Where were they before?
Yeah,
it just
exactly.
Doesn't change overnight. So, you know, I know you only got a minute left, but it's the key. It's the key to getting this thing turned around. And it's millions of those dollars. So
yeah, absolutely.
That money can go back into great, great plans and back to Oregonians if we can.
That's right. The fraud and waste is just astronomical, and you're right. We could be using that so much better. All right, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into his unique background and what his time in the Blue Angels taught him. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking with Greg Wooldridge, a Republican candidate for governor. He is a former Navy pilot and a commander of the world-famous Blue Angels, the only commander who ever led them on three tours. And I'd like to talk about your unique background. In fact, let's actually start there. Why is that unique that someone would lead the Blue Angels on three tours?
Yeah, Mark, it's usually a two-year tour, and then you leave the team. You talk about commanding the team. It's a player-coach type relationship. I'm out in the number one jet in front of the formation, and then when we get on the ground, of course, the whole time I'm responsible for the team. I take full responsibility as a commanding officer. So that's the relationship I had. Now, it's normally a two-year tour, what we call a tour, and then you go on and go do something else because it's pretty intense. This is something a lot of people don't know. The Blue Angels is just a part of a person's Navy tour or tour duty, their career. So So I did 2 years, and then I went away for about 6 months, and the commander of the team who had taken over from me had to step aside. But I came back for about a year, well, not quite a year, about 8-9 months, and led the team the rest of the time for him, which is unusual. And then about 2.5 years later, the guys on the team stopped wanting to fly with the leader. They were afraid he was going to kill them.
Wow.
So morale was rock bottom, and I was getting ready to retire from the Navy, and I got called from Washington. They said, would you consider coming back? And I said, well, stretch out my retirement date, and sure, I'll do it. Hmm. With no guarantees, because I hadn't flown in 2.5 years. And I went back, and we got it together and had a very successful season after that. So those are my three times. It's occasionally some guys will do it twice in extremis for somebody, but never three times.
Hmm. Well, I think it must say something about you that your commanders wanted you back for that third time. One of the things that people may not know about the Blue Angels, and I mentioned this in the last segment, is that it's not just these pilots who have to have extreme precision. I mean, you're flying like 3 feet away from your wingman there, and you're flying at 400 miles an hour. But it's the entire team, the ground crew and so on, who all have to be high performers. One little mistake, one little screw not tightened down, and it could be a complete disaster. Talk to us about what it takes to lead a precision team where everything has to go right and everyone has to do their job 100% right 100% of the time.
Right. It goes back to that trust factor. We build that trust. We have a culture of excellence. So culture in any organization is so critical. We said thank you a lot. We shook hands a lot. And one of our catchphrases was glad to be here. Mm-hmm. And that reflected that thankfulness, that gratitude to get to work with the people we got to work with. Now, there were six planes in the air that flew, the six of us, and we were flashing around, as George Will would say, there's a in any event or any organization, there's the group that are the lightning. You know, they flash around. It could be the sales, people in sales that are out there with the public, but in the background is the thunder. The thunder is the strength of the organization. Mm. The men and women that gave us the airplanes to fly, that filed the files, that swept the floors, no matter what they did, they had ownership in the outcomes of that team, and they felt it, they knew it, and they took pride in that, and it was so cool.
You know, and I think that certainly taps into a lot of what Trump was saying, too, in his successful run, is that it's those people that are so often forgotten. You know, I used to call him the forgotten man, and forgotten right. No longer. But I hear elements of that in what you're saying, is that it's those people behind the scenes that often don't get the credit, but everybody knows they're so critical to how an organization runs.
Well, and that's an important part of leadership. You start from the top. You make that known that you appreciate everybody in your organization. I mean, I would when I go into an office to meet with someone that I'm going to give a presentation to, the person that greets me, I learn their name. I share thoughts with them because I know how important their job is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to, and sometimes you could say the first person you see in an outfit is the VP of first impressions. So,
yeah.
You know, and so it's very important to recognize that everybody has a major role in the success of the enterprise. So,
well, I know that because we in my MBA days and also in my doctorate level, we studied high performance teams. And that mm-hmm. is something that always kind of mystified me, where so much attention is put on the C-suite, where you've got, you know, the CEOs mm-hmm. and the chief financials and, you know, the C's and the various acronyms. But so right. little attention is given to the front men, as you say. And it's often a shame to me that so many companies invest so much in those upper-level managers in terms of time and development and everything else. But then it's those people, like you say, that make the first impression that don't get paid as much as they ought to be, that get overlooked, that don't get the trainings, that don't get everything else. And a lot of times it's a thankless job, and yet it is so critical to that organization's success. So how do you then start translating that into efficiency within government?
That's a good one. Again, you have to give people expectations.
Hmm.
If you don't outline
yes.
clear yeah. and bold expectations, people are going to wander. They're going
yes.
to wander. I call it in my training, I call it having a center point. People need to have a center point well-defined with how you expect them to get it done. And then you give them feedback. You know, you can let them just flounder along and not be doing the right job, but you've got to give feedback. You can expect what you inspect, kind of is the thing. And to get the inefficiencies out of government, it just starts from the top down, and you build those expectations and work on it. So it can be done.
Yeah, and then hold them responsible for not meeting those expectations. All right,
exactly.
Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll wrap things up with Greg Wooldridge. He is a Republican candidate for governor. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now on the iSpy Radio Show, talking with Greg Wooldridge. He is running for the Republican nomination for the governor of Oregon. This has been a get-to-know-you kind of interview, and then we'll have him back a little bit later on to talk about policy a little bit more in depth. And in case you're just joining us, he is a retired Navy captain and former commander of the Navy Blue Angels. See, I should mention that you weren't just the commander of that's a minor accomplishment. You weren't just the commander of the Navy Blue Angels, but you were a commander of a naval base as well.
That was... You know what? Everybody says, boy, leading the Blue Angels must have been the pinnacle of your career. Actually, being able to build a team and lead that base, the biggest Navy jet base in the country, a fantastic place, but out in the middle of the cotton fields of Central California, but a great place to raise kids and do flight operations, which was our charter. But it was like a small state. It had everything. It had airport with two 13,500-foot runways. We had hospitals. We had stores. We had schools. We had public safety, you know, security, everything you could imagine in a state. And I had such a great team, yet the responsibility came back to me. Whenever things went wrong, it was right on me, and that's fine. And I accepted that, and I thrived on that, going after making things work right and being open and answerable.
Well, and responsibility is just something you don't hear very often when it comes to government workers or government anything. We hear about $300 million wasted on a study to determine whether or not we need a bridge crossing the Columbia. Billions of dollars are wasted every year on various programs. I know that one of our big bugaboos when it comes to the environment is the amount of waste on global warming studies. Fiscal year 2014, the Obama White House spent $22.2 billion on global warming initiatives over the possibility that maybe if we do everything that they say over the next 50 years, we might lower the Earth's temperature by half a degree. It's just an astonishing amount of the waste there, and that there just never seems to be any responsibility. In terms of actually firing people from government, where do you stand on that? How do you get them? How do you end up firing them when there are so many protections to keep them there?
All right. Well, that's a good question. But if you can absolutely prove that there's negligence, then they have to go. I'm a believer in second chances when that's allowable, because sometimes you can engender incredible loyalty if you can give somebody a second chance. If they haven't done something intentionally, maliciously, or, totally out of the realm of acceptance. However, if you've got people in positions of authority and they are willfully or knowingly doing something that isn't along the goals or in the line with the goals of the organization, you have to be able to fire them. And we'll fight to do that. When that comes up in the state, we will fight to do that. And I know there'll be those that'll try to protect them, but we'll work with the unions and other folks, and we'll show people that it's best for the state. And, you have to be a shepherd of the state's money and make sure that people are getting their money's worth.
Absolutely. We've talked about efficiency on a number of levels. Just looking at the government in rather broad terms right now, are there areas in particular that you see as especially wasteful?
Well, I think one of Dennis Richardson's finds about Medicaid was the 14% of the folks that got services that weren't entitled to them, to the tune of $72 million. And then there's another, 70% that we're not sure that haven't responded, that we haven't made that determination yet. That's a big area where we can cut back waste. And there are several more that just need to be looked at real closely. But big numbers, millions.
Oh, absolutely. Hundreds of millions. I know within the Oregon Health Authority, there's a tremendous amount of waste. And now, of course, with that new health care tax, as we discussed last week, that new health care tax that we just put in, they're already looking to divert some of those funds into things that they had said what they would never do and never mentioned when they got that passed as well. In the minute and a half or 2 minutes or so that we've got here with you, I'd like to return to something. You use this simple phrase, glad to be here, as part of your efforts to get more efficiency out of people. And that's deceptively simple, I think, especially when you look at government and how many people in government actually say that. I mean, that they're glad to be here. I know that when I've gone into government buildings, a lot of them seem this is almost like torture for them to be here. I just think if you could get people within government to really have that notion of being glad to be here, that alone would raise a lot of efficiency right there.
It has to start at the top. Yes. You have to project that your gratitude for having the people that are around you. And once you do that and it filters down along with that glad to be here, because you have a gratitude and a thank you for them being with you and helping you and doing the right job, it builds that culture, it builds that mindset. But along with that comes respect. So you respect the people that you're glad to be with. And when that respect filters down, that also builds a sense of oneness and team and ownership. And that's what we're looking for. We want people to feel like they own outcomes. When the outcomes are good, that's strong. When they're fair, let's work on getting it better. We can do better. We can make this happen. Let's take a look. How are we going to do this? So it is. It's a great motto. It just has real deep meaning.
So it's January 2019. You're governor. What needs to be fixed in Oregon first, you think?
My top three are education, infrastructure, getting those roads built, getting those 72 failing bridges rebuilt, and opening up lanes of commerce. If we can't get the commerce moving and moving fast, we're not going to build the tax base up by encouraging people to be here. Education, I'll go back to that. We've got to do better with our young people. I mean, they are failing and leaving school. And then PERS, we got to take a close look at PERS and get that fixed. I got some great ideas on doing that with a couple of real brains that I'm going to pull in. So those are my first three, and we're going to get after it.
Those are certainly big chunks to take out. And if you can accomplish those in your first term, that would be awesome. Greg Wooldridge, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We'll definitely have to have you back.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here anytime.
There's an article on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com that we found actually through Greg. It's about a political witch hunt, a classic example of government not wanting to be held accountable or responsible. A mom had gotten involved in the Portland School District, and Dennis Richardson appointed her to the State Board of Education. Except the board doesn't like being held accountable, so they have tried everything to get rid of her. They tried to change their own rules, even enlisting the help of the legislature to try to get her removed. That's the kind of thinking that Greg is talking about that needs changed, where Salem actually wants to be held responsible to the people they're supposed to be serving, not run from it. You can find that at iSpyRadio.com, links to Greg's website, his Twitter feed, and more, and give us a follow too at iSpyRadio, and help us spread the word, won't you? Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.